It's the 5th of April 2013, and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a podcast about interesting things. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up this week, we answer the questions. Could rich countries buying up developing nations' resources leave them dead in the lack of water? Is it game over for Atari? And will rubbish puns like that mean that I might level up? What can secularists and humanists learn from the 1960s? And is the fascist footballer less a case of Sieg Heil and more a case of Sieg Hired? But before we begin, of course, the begging slot. If you enjoy the Pod Delusion and would like to support what we do, then please do subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month, or make a one-off donation. All donations are hugely appreciated and help us keep making the show week in, week out. You can find links to donate at poddelusion.co.uk. Now, we start the show this week with a special report by new contributor Chris Fitch, who has been looking at the phenomenon of land grabbing, which is currently taking the developing world by storm and then taking the water from that storm back to the developed countries. Trust me, that metaphor will make a lot more sense after you've listened to this amazing piece. Here's Chris to explain more.
It's not exactly breaking news to say that people in richer countries tend to quite like dropping by poorer countries and generally doing whatever they want with them. Rich countries, especially those in Western Europe, have spent most of the past 500 years traipsing around the world, landing in various new locations, and generally claiming to own everything they find before disappearing off home with as many valuable items as they can lay their hands upon. And while many things may have changed over that time, sadly this isn't one of them, just the name. Now we call it land grabbing. Very simply, land grabbing is the name for when wealthy countries and corporations buy up land from governments of poorer regions of the world so that they can profit from the resources that the land offers, often without consultation with, or consideration of, the local people who live or work on that land.
The view is that governments should, if you like, privatise that land, sell it on, give it away under long-term leases to foreign investors. And that's what's going on.
That voice belongs to Fred Pearce, environment consultant at New Scientist magazine and author of the book The Land Grabbers, The New Fight Over Who Owns the Earth.
There's half a billion people who are basically being told, well, you know, you're not using your land as efficiently as we would like. We're going to take it off you. Now, definitions of efficiency are very difficult. The people are using the land very efficiently so far as they're concerned, but maybe not much money is getting into the national coffers of the government in the capital. Governments are very keen to commodify their land in a way that generates something that you can measure in dollars. So the foreign sugar company, the foreign palm oil company, the foreign logging company, all coming in and saying, we will invest in your country, we'll provide you with foreign investment if you give us your land. And the governments are not asking too many questions, and they're certainly not asking the consent of the people, the farmers, the herders, the forest dwellers who control that land. It's about power here. We're talking about control of the most fundamental resource of rural communities in predominantly rural countries.
That resource? Water. In the past, it may have been about gold or oil, but in the 21st century, it's all going to be about water.
We're going to be talking a lot about water in the coming decades. It's becoming a critical resource. People talk about it in the same way as they used to talk about oil, as sort of the critical resource for economic development in many countries.
On a very basic level, agriculture is very water intensive. It requires a lot of water to grow the food that we eat in the developed world. And these days, land and water are both a lot cheaper in the developing world.
Because the Middle East and Europe come to that, where we import very large amounts of food, really essentially because we don't have enough water to grow the crops that we need. So there's a kind of hidden trade in water around the world in the form of food. They call it virtual water.
So water is increasingly becoming a very valuable resource. And yet, local governments, when trying to raise funds by selling off their land, aren't really doing very much to protect their water as an asset.
They're very short of money. They believe that they should be investing in agriculture, and I think that's right. And somebody turns up with some money and says, we'll invest in your agriculture. They don't think too much about whether it's good investment or bad investment. So they'll tend to sign contracts which will, first of all, allow companies to take their profits out very quickly, but also will allow them to take almost any resources that they want that are necessary to do the agriculture. And generally speaking, water is the most precious asset. The land is no use without water. One reason why the Saudi Arabians, for instance, are probably the biggest land grabbers in the world, Saudi Arabia has plenty of land, spare land, but it has no water. What it wants is water that you can irrigate, and it's been going around large areas of Africa to find precisely that. The real danger is that companies and countries that are buying up land are buying up water from countries which are already very short of water. The classic instances are Sudan and Ethiopia, both countries with severe food shortages, certainly at certain times in certain places, and a history of famines, but which are handing over very large amounts of their land to foreign investors from India, from Saudi Arabia, from Europe, in the belief that it will bring development, but they're actually handing over the resources which would allow it to feed their own people in future.
Essentially, these foreign landowners get themselves permission to take and use all of the water that rains upon, or is accessible from below, land that they purchase. This not only stops local people from benefiting from that land, but in many cases leaves communities further downstream with no water at all for their own agriculture. And so, in January 2013, the journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences of the United States of America, volume 110, featured the first peer-reviewed study entitled Global Land and Water Grabbing, investigating exactly how widespread the phenomenon of land grabbing has become, and how much water the foreign entities are removing from the land they purchase.
So we wanted to quantify the amount of water that is grabbed with this land.
Here's one of the authors.
I'm Paolo Dodorico, professor at the University of Virginia. There are two different types of water that are used by agriculture. Water that comes in the form of precipitation on the agricultural land, which is implicitly bought by the land, and then the water that can be supplied in the form of irrigation. And the second type of water may also be available in the area, and so by introducing new investments for agriculture in these regions, these foreign corporations can also make investments in irrigation. By developing irrigation systems, they would then go and get some of the water from the streams and rivers in the region. The numbers are pretty big, so we found that these water grabs can range between 0.3 and 0.45, 10 to the 12 cubic meters per year.
Some quick mathematics, that works out at between 300 and 450 cubic kilometers, or using the International Guide for Measuring Large Volumes of Liquids, potentially as many as 180 million Olympic-sized swimming pools every single year.
This is a huge number, and to put this in the right context, this is a substantial fraction of the total amount of water that is used for food production around the world. And so this means that by securing access to these water resources, foreign corporations implicitly exclude the local populations from the access to these resources, which could be very important to improve food security in some of these grabbed countries.
Other results from the study include that current rates of grabbed land worldwide range from 32.7 million to 82.2 million hectares, and that 33% of grabbed land is in Asia, while nearly half, 47%, is in Africa.
The most grabbed continent is Africa, and countries particularly affected by land grabbing are Indonesia, the Philippines, Sudan.
The problem with all these figures, though, most especially with rates of water removal from the land, is that it is so extremely hard to find out precise numbers of who has bought what and what has been removed.
These numbers are big, but they represent only potential water grabs, because at this point we don't know if all crops have already been planted in this grabbed land.
We're very unsure about how much land is being grabbed. We're even less sure about water. It's bad news, but how bad is difficult to tell. So there have been some misleading statistics put around suggesting that large amounts of water is already being taken for the land grabs. I think that's overdone, because while the risks of water grabbing are very, very large, I think the actual grabbing is at a low level so far. That doesn't give me cause for think, well, we're okay. That just means we ain't seen nothing yet.
What is clear from the study, though, is that land grabbing in this way has been a growing trend.
This phenomenon has really accelerated in the last few years. The peak seems to be around 2009-2010, It's explained mostly as a consequence of this increase of food prices in the last few years in the response to the food crisis of 2007-2008. And so they make investments in these lands, and I think the plan is to increase the productivity of these lands, and then at that point we can really say that they will be using an amount of water that is comparable to what we are reporting in our study. The phenomenon apparently slowed down a little bit in the last year or year and a half, but it's just increasing. So the number of foreign land acquisitions and the size of these grabbed lands is constantly increasing in time.
It's hard to be sure where this is going, certainly in the short term. There are bubbles. You know, we may be seeing a sort of land grab bubble going on. A lot of it will depend on commodity prices. You know, if sugar prices go up, people are going to want to grab more land for sugar. If grain prices are going up, similarly. The judgment of many people is that all these commodity prices, agricultural commodity prices, are on a long-term upsurge because of shortages of land and resources to grow the crops. For a long-term upward trend for those kinds of commodities, there are going to be more and more people who want to buy up land to grow those commodities. I think we can be pretty certain about that.
One quote from the study is particularly telling. Land grabbing is a new form of colonialism.
In many ways, I think it's worse, because what we're seeing now is circumstances where Indian companies or Saudi companies or City of London investors, they can just pull out if they don't like it, but they can't be held to account in the way that you could be held to account within an empire. So in some respects, it's even worse.
It has been argued that land grabbing can bring new investments, create new jobs in parts of the developing world. And so some people have been trying to argue that there are some positives associated with land grabbing. However, many other studies tend to show that there has not been a big increase in jobs or in employment opportunities in the grabbed countries, and that most of the profits of these foreign investments in agriculture are not really shared with the local populations.
The stakes could not be higher. What are they supposed to do? It's about two things, as far as I'm concerned. It's about human rights. It's about the injustice of having a resource like land taken from you with no recompense. And it is about different ideas about how you do economic development in poor countries, particularly in Africa. Can you do it by simply inviting in foreign investors and hoping that there will be a trickle-down effect? Sometimes there will. Mostly in agricultural land grab, I don't believe there will be. And the evidence of what I've seen travelling around the world looking at is that communities lose out when the land grabbers move in.
This is Christopher Fitch for The Pod Delusion.
Now, if you're a regular listener to this programme, you'll have noticed that we regularly cover campaigns by humanist and secularist groups to do things like get rid of faith schools or get people to express their non-belief on the census. But can we really expect any of these campaigns to actually work? One of the ways of predicting the answer to this question might be to look back at history, which is what historian of education Rob Freethy from Exeter University did in a recently published paper. So should we continue sticking it to the man, or should we give up, go home and have a cry? Here's Liz Luckendorf finding out. She started by asking him to outline exactly what his paper was all about.
Well, I'm a historian of education, and specifically about religious education. And I'm really interested in the factors that affected changes and developments in that curriculum subject so as to explain how it came to its current form. So how did it get to where it is now? And we were doing a large project, which was called The Hidden History of Religious Education. And there were two things that were hidden about it. One was we were using archival material, stuff that nobody had ever looked at before. And the other thing we were trying to do was to identify factors of influence that people had ignored. And it was while digging away in the National Archives in Kew that we discovered some materials that were from the National Secular Society and from the British Humanist Association, where they were seeking to influence policy on religious education at a national level. And that kind of snowballed, really, as we learnt more and more about the way the British Humanist Association, National Secular Society, but also individual secularists and humanists, you know, actively sought to either abolish religious instruction, as it was called then, or they sought to replace it with something else, like moral education, or they sought to reform it, to broaden it in some way, so that it wasn't just Christian, it was also world religions and other non-religious philosophies as well.
There are several kind of key pieces of legislation. So there's the Education Act of 1944. There's one again in 1988. What's the kind of long view of the development of RE?
I think the major thing to emphasise here is that before 1870, there are no state schools. You know, almost all schools are run by the churches. It's either the Church of England or it's nonconformist groups like Methodists and Baptists and so on. They were funded by the churches, they were controlled by the churches, and religious instruction played a core part, you know, of every day, really. Then, of course, you got the development after 1870 of state schools, and they had to make a decision of these schools that were funded by the state as to were they going to be Christian or not, were they going to be Christian or secular institutions. And they kind of made a bit of a fudge, really, and they were going to be non-denominationally Christian. So then you got what's called, we call the dual system, church and state schools developed. And it was only in 1944 that they decided religious instruction, as it was then, had to be made compulsory. And you can't really understand the legislation we have now without understanding how it was born in that wartime context. You know, Britain saw itself as a Christian country. We were fighting fascists, communists, Nazis, and all of them were portrayed as being secular ideologies, rightly or wrongly, but they were perceived like that. And really, since 1944, the legislation's not changed very much. It's still weekly religious education, it's now called, and it's still determined on a local level by agreed syllabuses. And these are syllabuses which are written by four committees, Church of England, other religious groups, it used to be other Christian groups, the local educational authority, reps, and also teachers. And that's still the case today.
Your paper seemed to indicate that the historiography of this topic seems to have ignored the things like what you found out in the media and the organisations themselves and focused, as you said in your paper, on kind of intellectuals and more or less the church view of things. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, that's right. And I think it's because most of that history has been written by people that aren't really historians. They're people that are really interested in what's going on now. They're interested in contemporary debates, current policy and practice. And I think sometimes they're using the history as a kind of as a lever by which to sort of make some contemporary points. So they're interested particularly in the history of ideas because they're interested in current theories, current policies. But they're often not interested in the historical factors and context in which those ideas originated. So sometimes it's sort of cherry-picking, you know, the great thinkers from the past. They're usually men, you know, it's the great men of history. And they don't really think about, you know, all that complexity, all the social, cultural, political and economic factors that go into, educational, like I say, policy, theory, practice and so on.
One of the things that I was intrigued by is that you mentioned that the humanists and secularists didn't do as well as they thought, but the results of the reform in 1988 seems to have had the same effect.
Yeah, I'm not sure I totally agree with that interpretation. I think the key thing is that where they sought to change legislation, they failed, because the 1988 legislation is to all intents and purposes the same as the 1944 legislation. In fact, what you got in the lead-up to 1988 was a backlash from sort of Christian conservatives who said, no, we want to ensure that Christianity is taught. In the 1988 Education Reform Act, what you get are the statements that religious education should be mainly Christian and collective worship has to be wholly or mainly of a broadly Christian nature. So those statements seem to be very much against the secular and humanist campaigns. But what you get in terms of theory, not policy, not legislation, but in terms of theory and practice in religious education is very much more on the lines of what they were campaigning for. So the subject, in the main, ceases to try and promote a particular religious philosophy, a particular religious standpoint, and it seems to be much broader in its content. So it is world religions, and sometimes it's things like humanism, even communism was being taught in some syllabuses. So in theory and practice, I think they had an influence, but in terms of policy and legislation, they didn't.
Do you think the humanists and secularists who campaign on this can draw any lessons from your research?
I'd like to think that there are lessons to be drawn from it, but I wouldn't say they are just for the secularists and the humanists. The thing that impressed me most in the, you know, the archival materials is when you get people with very, very deep-seated convictions who are able to sit round a table with other people who have opposing convictions, and they're able to dialogue across that difference. They're able to discuss the issue, identify where they agree, identify where they disagree, and then come to some kind of common solution. And you've got a lot of that between the Christians and religious educators on the one hand, and particularly British Humanist Association and its representatives on the other. There are lots of examples of them coming together and collaborating really effectively. And I think where they did so, they were really taking seriously, you know, their opponents' points of view. They were trying to be empathetic, they were trying to be understanding. And in actual fact, I think it's a really good model of what perhaps religious education should look like. You know, it should be plural, it should be diverse, it should be about how we live together in harmony despite these profound philosophical differences between us.
So from an international perspective, is this kind of a unique thing?
Well, some aspects of it are unique, but overall, I would say it's not really unique. There's great diversity internationally. So you do get countries which have dealt with the problem of religion by excluding it, you know, and there is a clear demarcation between church and state. You know, France is a good example where they try and keep religion out of schools. But there are other examples internationally where all of the education, all of the schooling is denominational. You know, it's divided up by religion. And they receive state funding. You know, I mean, the Netherlands is a good example. You know, they're very tolerant of, you know, religiously affiliated schools receiving state funding. And then, of course, that's on the institutional level. But there are other examples where children attend the same school, but then they get split off for their religious education lesson. So you'll go to Protestant religious education and you'll go to Catholic religious education or whatever it may be. And in the UK, in the 1960s, that was certainly on the table. The idea that particularly, how do we deal with immigrants who are bringing into this country a great diversity of different religions? And what's really fascinating, I think, is when you get the same historical factors influencing the development of the subject, but each system of education comes to its own solution. It's a different solution. So it doesn't mean if you've got immigration and you've got secularisation and you've got this, that and the other, you will end up with something like we have in the UK. Actually, exactly the same factors might yield a very different answer, a very different response. And that's really exciting and a great headache to a historian.
You'll have to look at individual people and things like that who may have had an opinion on it.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, individual, you know, thinkers. I mean, in this country, somebody like Ninian Smart, he established the first religious studies department at Lancaster University. Well, he's a huge influence over the subject. And then you think, if it wasn't for Lancaster doing that, as opposed to theology, you know, religious studies, not theology, if it wasn't for Ninian Smart, would we have had the kind of religious education that we have today?
Very cool. Well, thank you very much for this interview. And we'll put a link up to where you can download the paper if you have the right whatever university access to download it. But yes, thank you very much.
That's okay. Thank you.
Now, being in the video games business can certainly be rather up and down, or in the case of Konami, up, up, down, down, left, right, B and A. Come on, about probably 1% of you will appreciate that reference, but I think it was worth it. But anyway, for Atari, times are hard. Earlier this year, they went bust again, only 10 years after their first rescue. But why are they struggling? Is there a way out? And what of their legacy? Here's Alex Fitch, who I don't think is related to our earlier contributor, Chris Fitch, with more.
10 years ago, last weekend, March the 31st, 2003, the most recent incarnation of Atari, Atari Inc., was formed, a version of the company that lasted less than a decade, as Atari Inc. filed for bankruptcy in January this year. So even as British, Latin American and Eastern European retro game fans were gearing up to see the latest multi-million dollar CGI cartoon by Disney, Wreck-It Ralph, which featured cameos by characters such as the Bat and Ball from Pong and the eponymous Paperboy, Atari itself, creator of these games, was going to the wall. A wall which sales of Pong on mobile devices isn't going to be able to successfully break out of. Of course, a company doesn't have to go bankrupt in order to be shut down. this week's unexpected closing of LucasArts, a very successful software manufacturer of both Star Wars games and other franchises, is obviously due to new owners Disney consolidating their portfolio and getting rid of brands that don't have a Mickey Mouse logo on them. However, 2013 is a year of anniversaries for Atari. There's the aforementioned Atari Inc.'s decade of existence, and its sister company, Atari Interactive, would have celebrated its 15th anniversary a month ago if it too hadn't filed for bankruptcy in January this year. 2013 is also the 20th anniversary of Atari's final games console, the Atari Jaguar, a slightly rubbish machine that never managed to fully compete with the first Sony PlayStation, which launched a year later. Nostalgia's a funny thing. While I don't quite understand the appeal of retro games to kids today, for people of my generation, who grew up with the first Atari consoles in the late 1970s and early 80s, we have fond memories of the sprite-based classics of our youth. However, on playing them today, few are as good as we remember, and certainly not in emulation. In recent years, I've downloaded ports of classic video games, such as Atari Stalwart Pitfall and Nintendo Superhero Mega Man, to various devices, and found them almost unplayable, which seems at odds with the hours of fun I remember having exploring their digital territories as a child. Sprite-based games in general, from before about 1990, do little to impress me anymore, and the games that still have an appealing aesthetic from before then, vector-based games such as Star Wars and Tempest, are still less playable than more modern remakes such as Star Wars Arcade and Tempest 2000, which both hail from the early 1990s. However, let's consider the heyday of Atari before we consider its demise. The very first video game, and also arcade game, that the public, rather than technicians in labs, had access to, was launched in November 1971 and called Computer Space. Other than cameos in films such as Soylent Green and Jaws, the game wasn't a massive cultural success, but its creators, Nolan Bushnell and Ted Dabney, went on to manufacture the Pong arcade machine in 1972, under the name of their new company, Atari, a Japanese word which means to hit the target, and also an expression for success. And this machine, which sold for 3 times its production cost, sold more than 8,000 units over the next 2 years to bars and arcades. When released as a console-type machine for plugging into TVs, Pong was sold to 150,000 households by the end of 1975. Neither Pong or Computer Space were hardly new games in terms of their on-screen action. Earlier iterations of both had existed in computer labs since the late 1950s and early 60s. But what Atari excelled at in the early years was packaging, branding, and marketing, bringing out various versions of their most famous product, such as the sequels Pong Doubles, Super Pong, Quadra Pong, Pin Pong, and Puppy Pong in the mid-1970s to consumers who were happy to buy the same thing over and over again. In 1976, Atari finally had the bright idea of making the game more interesting by giving you an enemy, in inverted commas, to defeat, and released the brick-smashing game Breakout. The first cartridge-based games console that Atari released was 1977's VCS, Video Computer System, and it played games that were more than variants of hitting bats against balls. Having rebranded it, the Atari 2600, in 1980, the machine would stay in production for an amazing 15 years, and was then again re-released as the Atari Flashback console in 2004, the latest version of which, the Atari Flashback 4, was released as recently as last year. In 1980 alone, Atari was bringing in revenues of $2 billion from games, consoles, and accessories, and in its first 5 years, the Atari 2600 sold 10 million units. However, while the company made other excellent products in the years to come, such as the Atari ST home computer in 1985, the Atari 7800 console in 1986, and the Atari Lynx handheld game console in 1989, it never had as massive a hit on its hands again. Indeed, the Lynx, while graphically superior to its monochrome rival, the Nintendo Game Boy, never sold in huge numbers, and Atari's final games console, the Atari Jaguar, released in 1983, was a flop due to the small number of games that were ever released for it, despite it being the initial home for the Alien vs. Predator franchise. In hindsight, the Atari Jaguar's original advertising slogan, "Do the Math," referring to its superior calculating power compared to its contemporaries, was ill-chosen, as that's exactly what consumers did, and found rival machines a better investment for their time and money. Since 1976, Atari had been owned by Warner Communications, the company being sold when Nolan Bushnell needed additional funds to develop the Atari VCS, raising around $30 million in the process. In 1984, when the original video game market collapsed, a year before Nintendo broke America, Warner split the company into various divisions, selling the consumer department to Commodore Computer's founder Jack Tramiel for $240 million worth of stock, but only $50 cash in hand. When it was sold again in March 1998 to the toy manufacturer Hasbro, it was valued as only $5 million, a sixth of what Warner had originally paid, and a tiny fraction of Tramiel's purchase. And that doesn't even take into account its value adjusted for inflation. So when did Atari really come to an end? That's not an easy question to answer. Some might say this year, when Atari Inc. and Atari Interactive filed for bankruptcy. Some might say 1996, when Atari ceased production of the Jaguar and became a software publisher only. And certainly 96 was the year when Atari became a games manufacturer pretty much in name alone, as the Atari brand was passed from company to company, each hoping to cash in on the kudos of the name and the chance to remake its classic titles. That said, Atari consoles have continued to be made by other companies, such as At Games, who are the manufacturers of the Flashback series, and in terms of Atari's legacy, some of the creators of the Jaguar console and its games went on to make another, albeit short-lived console, called the Nuon, which was licensed to various manufacturers to produce, such as Samsung and Toshiba. At the time of its release, 1999, the machine showcased the latest sequel to one of Atari's finest game franchises, Tempest, not to mention other companies' game franchises, such as Tetris and Space Invaders. The Nuon was a terrific idea, a chipset that, along with joystick ports, could be put inside any DVD player to turn it into a games machine. But like some of the machines made by Atari themselves, such as the Lynx and the Jaguar, it never found its market, and never had enough top-quality titles made for it. At the turn of the century, the name Atari traded hands again, this time sold by Hasbro to French company Infogrames, and in 2008, Infogrames also bought all of Atari Inc.'s remaining public shares. The French company then decided to do away with their original name in 2009 and become solely named Atari SA, Société Anonyme, to reflect the brand's new location as a company, as SA is the French equivalent of PLC, and it is Atari SA that went bankrupt this year. But the death of this version of Atari is really only the death of the company formerly known as Infogrames. So in some respects, you can consider Atari a company that has no longer existed since 1996, or, if the brand itself is all that matters, it's one that, if not alive and well, is certainly undead, via the latest iterations of the Flashback consoles made by At Games and Pong-related mobile titles. Whether another company can use the Atari legacy for a new generation of remakes and sequels of their classic titles is another question. Hasbro and Infogrames had some success with new versions of old Atari games, but the problem that dogs Atari's old franchises is that none of them have instantly recognizable characters that can be reinvented or have name recognition, i.e. there's nothing like Namco's Pac-Man, Sega's Sonic the Hedgehog, or Nintendo's Mario on their books. And this might be one reason the company's fortunes have dwindled over the last couple of decades, as the branding of games and their characters became as important in the public's consciousness as the games themselves. The fondness and nostalgia that retro gamers and the makers of Wreck-It Ralph have for the Atari brand probably means it won't be too long before another company does pick up the name and its distinctive three-pronged logo. Whether it is a company that can turn around the aging property's fortunes is another matter. But for fans of Pong, Paperboy, Breakout, Asteroids, Tempest, Battlezone, Centipede, Lunar Lander, Missile Command, Gauntlet, and many more, here's hoping there's life in those old pixels yet. This has been Alex Fitch, picking up his joystick one more time for the Pod Delusion.
Now, football news. But don't worry, this is actually interesting. It turns out that footballers, who I'd previously assumed were great intellectuals, actually have some rather backwards and unpleasant views. This week we found out that Di Canio, who I'm told is a footballer, has been appointed as the manager of a football team, despite identifying as a fascist. I'm presuming he was a right winger. Here's Sean Slater, kicking off this next report.
In order to get to the Stadium of Light, the home of Sunderland Football Club, supporters may travel along the north bank of the River Weir on Keir Hardie Way. The arterial road is named after one of the founders of the Labour Party, who became a prominent union leader in Glasgow in the 1870s, and who in 1892 would be the first Labour Member of Parliament, winning the London constituency of West Ham South. One very different figure has a connection to these three places, and is in the news this week. The Mercurial former footballer turned football manager, Paolo Di Canio. This week he was named as manager of one of the Premiership perennial strugglers, Sunderland AFC, who had just last week dismissed their manager Martin O'Neill after a disappointing run of results. Now, football clubs sacking managers may be big news on Sky Sports and Talk Sport, but listeners to the Pod Delusion may be thinking that it is not the most interesting thing to add to the podcast about interesting things. But this one has a number of factors that make it worth including. Prominent amongst these is that Di Canio is a self-confessed fascist. Not a racist, he'll remind you, but a bona fide Italian fascist, a follower of Mussolini, Il Duce, the late and little-lamented leader of Italy. A native of Rome, Di Canio played for several clubs, amongst them Juventus and Turin, Celtic and Glasgow, Sheffield Wednesday and Charlton, but it is his connections to West Ham United and Lazio of Rome for which he is most famous. Controversy seemed to dog Di Canio. He left Juventus and AC Milan after disputes with the team managers. He engineered a move from Celtic because he thought the standard of player around him fell well below his own abilities. And at Sheffield, he famously pushed over the referee when being sent off against Arsenal for violent conduct. But it was at West Ham United, the club he joined after a lengthy ban, where he eventually found a home. His talents, and it is fair to say that he was a gifted and skillful player, were well matched to the club, and he became the darling of the fans in East London. After his retirement, he said that West Ham was the club he wanted to manage, and the club opened the Paolo Di Canio Lounge in the stadium in his honour. In the later years of his career, he ended up at his boyhood team Lazio in Rome. Unfortunately, Lazio have a core of neo-fascist supporters connected to the club. Mussolini was one of them. And Di Canio played to this gallery by doing fascist salutes, even though this resulted in a €7,000 fine and a match ban. Following a relatively successful playing career, though he never played for the Italian national team, in 2011 he became manager at Swindon Town, then in the fourth tier of English football. He guided Swindon to promotion to League One. Actually, that's the third tier, it's too complicated to explain here, in his first season, but was forced to resign halfway through the second due to severe budget restrictions at the club. He was loved by many of the fans there, and he personally paid the wages of some players when the club got into financial difficulties. In his biography, Di Canio admitted to being both a fascist and an admirer of Mussolini, calling him basically a very principled, ethical individual who was deeply misunderstood. Despite this, he denied being a racist, and there are no reports of any overt racism in his career from any other player or manager. The GMB union cancelled their sponsorship of Swindon Town when he was appointed, and though there were a few eyebrows raised, his stint at Swindon was largely ignored by the wider press, and his on-field success meant that the fans there mostly supported him. This can be compared to the firestorm that seemed to envelop his appointment at Sunderland. The press have gone to town, and in a fiery first press conference, Di Canio refused to even address the fascist question, despite repeated attempts to get him to confirm or retract the statements in his autobiography. It remains to be seen whether the fans will continue to support him as manager of their club. There is already a Facebook group called Sunderland Against Fascist Di Canio that has 4,500 likes. The Durham Miners Association condemned the appointment. The stadium stands on the site of a former pit. And the Labour leader's brother, David Miliband, resigned as a member of the club's board. However, Di Canio has now stated that he is not political and that he does not support the ideology of fascism. The Durham Miners have accepted this and have had assurance that their union banner will still be displayed at the ground, and Miliband's resignation could also be explained by personal and political expediency, as he is due to move to the USA shortly. Even the Facebook group is no longer active. I fully expect that what will happen is the same as when all controversial figures are appointed at a football team. If he is successful, then all will be forgotten. If he fails, then any stick to beat him with will be used. I've seen this so often the decades I've spent watching and loving the beautiful game. Racism is condemned, but so often forgiven or brushed aside. Actions that should lead to censure by the club or the sporting authorities are too often ignored for the simple reason that its success is the be-all and end-all. Just this week, we had two strange cases. Carlos Tevez of Manchester City, who earns £196,000 a week, was fined and given community service for driving whilst already disqualified. Will he be sacked by his club? Not likely. His contract is worth millions of pounds to the club. Meanwhile, Francisco Sandaza of Scottish club Rangers was duped by a hoax call made by a supporter of a rival club, in which he gave the contract details and admitted he wanted away from Rangers, but was locked into a contract, was sacked by Rangers for breach of that contract. The difference here is that Sandaza was unsuccessful while still being highly paid, and his contract was worth next to nothing. At most elite football clubs, ethics is just the county where Southend United play. Money talks, and in today's multi-million TV and sponsors-funded game, morals are an unnecessary distraction. Too often, clubs use the rhetoric of moral indignation when it suits, but when it comes to the bottom line, their actions rarely meet the rhetoric. This is clearly seen in the disgusting actions of the European governing body UEFA. They fined one Danish player £80,000 for displaying an unapproved sponsor's name on his underpants, whilst, with a seemingly straight face, fined De Canio's former club Lazio £32,000 when its fans made monkey chants at black players. As in all walks of life, there are good people and bad people, and football is no exception. What is a greater evil is the focus of one man's, albeit stupid and ignorant, political views, whilst many of the institutions around him are corrupt and unethical to the point of absurdity. I've been Sean Slater, reporting for The Pod Delusion.
Now, could Google goggles help the blind to see? This week, Chris Hofstadter has been speaking to a man behind the new technology that translates images into sounds, which the brain then learns to interpret as images. It's all rather clever, and I'll let him explain more.
What does this look like to you? If you said, nothing, this is an audio-only podcast, you're correct. But if you're a blind person like me, using a remarkable new piece of software called The Voice, you will see images when you hear these sounds. And joining me now to talk about this software is Dr. Peter Meyer. Peter, can you describe it? Because obviously you know far more about your software than I do.
In essence, it's true. It's an approach that converts live images from a camera into sound in such a way that it preserves a lot of visual information, even pictorial information. So you can hear graphs, you can hear your environment, and so on and so forth. And in order to do that, you have to play some tricks. The bandwidth of hearing is lower than of vision, but our ability to hear fast changes is much better than our ability to see fast changes. And so we exchange the high spatial resolution of vision for the high temporal resolution of hearing. We scan each image that we get from the camera, and we take an image every second. We scan each image from left to right, and while doing so, we associate height with pitch, with frequency, and the horizontal position with time and a bit of stereo panning. And it may still sound a bit abstract, but if you imagine having, let's say, a bright diagonal line on a dark background running from the bottom left to the upper right, then it sounds something like weep, weep, because on the left side at the start of the diagonal, you only have a bright pixel low in elevation, so you have a low pitched tone, and then as you go to the right, the line rises and so does the tone until you reach the end of the soundscape in about 1 second.
I have found, in my using it now, it's been about 2 months, that I can identify all the examples. I can find things that are geometrically nicely shaped, door frames and nice rectangles. And I was able to find a coffee cup on my kitchen table.
Right.
But I'm still having trouble. I can't identify my dog as a dog quite yet.
Right, yeah. Typical natural shape, like the dog that you mentioned, or chairs, or tables. These are really complex shapes, and they don't give simple sounds, so they are very difficult to recognize based on the kind of rational analysis like you can do with an upright rectangle or a simple line or something like that. So yeah, it takes a lot of time, effort to really master seeing with sound, and it's actually still an open question how far people can get with it. Let's say that people practice with it for years, how far can they get?
By reading your website, there are three sort of technical concepts that are pretty unfamiliar to me, and I think to most of probably our listeners. And those are sensory substitution, neuroplasticity, and artificial synesthesia. So why don't we take those in order, and if you can speak to what is meant by sensory substitution and a bit of the neurology or neuroscience or cognitive science about how it works.
Sensory substitution is a term that was originally coined by Paul Bakurita, who started working about half a century ago using tactile displays to convey visual information. So you got an array of electrodes on your belly or on your back, and the images of a camera were conveyed via this matrix of electrodes. Essentially, it's nothing more than mapping the same information that you would normally get in via your eyes to something that you can perceive with your other senses or with your remaining senses if you're blind. And the way to do that differs per modality, and even for hearing, there are different ways of conveying visual information in sound. But the essence is that you map the information that's normally perceived via one sense via another sense.
And neuroplasticity is something we read about a lot in magazines like Scientific American, but can you speak to it, how it works specifically in this case?
Yeah, you could say it's a form of rewiring your brain. We have grown up in a certain way, and all the time during our development, as we grew up, neural connections were getting pruned and changed, and that allows us to learn quite a bit, to become very proficient in a number of skills. And it has been discovered for the last 15 years or so that even once we are adults, this change in wiring, which we call, or the consequence of neuroplasticity, which is the rewiring, doesn't stop. It continues, maybe slower than when you are a child, but it keeps continuing. And that's what we also try to use here, because we are now, with sensory substitution, mapping information meant for one modality to another modality. And that's quite a drastic change, because that other modality has never learned to cope with that, and it has to sort of decode that information. And in order to do that fluently, your brain has to learn to do that at a subconscious level. So in order to do that well, the brain has to adapt a lot, and that's where neuroplasticity comes in.
And then perhaps most interestingly, I mean, we all know what synesthesia is, and certainly people involved in scientific skepticism understand the concept of pareidolia, but artificial synesthesia, what is that?
With sensory substitution, there are two things that we are interested in. One is the functional benefit. Can we learn to decode, in the case of the voice, those soundscapes in a way that we can do useful things with it, like picking up a cup of coffee or something like that? But the other thing is that if you are late blind, then, well, you may have a great desire to have the old experience of seeing light when you perceive something visually or when you get visual information in. And that's another long-term and ambitious goal of sensory substitution, to not only give this functional benefit, but also to evoke really the visual experience that, well, like the late blind, remember it.
Where do you see the future of this technology? I mean, anyone who follows you on Twitter knows that you're an enthusiast of Google Glass.
Sure. That's something I dream of, and it's not too far away. What I hope is that this little camera that comes along with Google Glass can be used as the input for the voice. We have a version of the voice now that runs on Android phones, and I can imagine that in a year or so, if Google Glass is compatible with Android phones such that you can use it as a kind of external camera, then you can grab images from this augmented reality glasses device and convert those images on the fly into corresponding soundscapes and feed them back to the user. So then you can again use mass market technology, which will in a certain period of time become quite affordable. I mean, initially it will maybe be close to $1,000, I don't know, but over time, if it is a commercial success, then the price will go down. And then blind people can benefit from this mass market technology just like they already do when they work with computers.
Well, thank you, Peter, for joining us on the Pod Delusion.
Okay, thank you. That's great.
This has been Chris Gonsblinko-Hofstetter, Seeing with Sound, for the Pod Delusion.
Finally this week, a couple more clips from our live broadcast from the Royal Holloway Science Festival a couple of weeks ago. We were there all day broadcasting live to YouTube from the Student Union Bar, interviewing some of the scientists who work there, and you can see the videos in full on our YouTube channel. But now here's two interviews from later in the day, when me and Liz spoke to two child development psychologists.
This week we bring you a psychology doubleheader, which I'm sure is sort of a pun, with Professor Gene Shinsky and the Associate Dean of Science, Professor Patrick Lehman, both from the Department of Psychology. We'll start off with the young'uns, and I mean really young'uns, with Gene, who researches the cognitive development in infancy and early childhood.
So I'm interested in kind of basic cognitive abilities, like how kids think about the world in symbolic terms, in terms of not things that they can see concretely in front of them. So I'm kind of interested in normal, kind of typical cognitive development in the first few years in particular.
I was at the science banquet that they had at Royal Holloway last night, and one of your colleagues said, "You have a baby lab. What's a baby lab?"
So a baby lab is, we don't grow babies there, but we do tests on their cognitive abilities. So we bring in infants and their parents, just members of the local community who are interested in learning more about child development, and set up experiments where we can kind of try to get some information out of the infant in terms of what they think about things that they see around them.
So I guess there's been different kind of ways people have thought of children. If you go back to like the 19th century, they're like little normal people and things like that. How much has changed in developmental psychology when looking at children this young?
I think a lot in the last 100 years. People used to think that infants were a blank slate, and everything was learned from experience, that there wasn't anything that was sort of inborn that they could draw on biases or predispositions that they have to process the world. And I would say that's changed quite radically. I think there have been swings and shifts between more sort of nativist perspectives suggesting that infants actually do have quite a lot more inbuilt biases about how to interpret the world, and then sort of counter sways to that argue, no, but this aspect of this thing needs to be learned, and here's the evidence that it's learned rather than innate. So I think nowadays we are much, and especially with new methods that let you test infants in more ways and earlier in development, I think that people now are much more comfortable making arguments about the kinds of things that infants are capable of doing quite young and may even possibly be innate.
So one of the kind of things, maybe not so much now, but it used to be the nature versus nurture debate. Is that still a massive kind of
yes
debate?
It's a massive debate in the field of psychology in general, and in child development in particular. It still remains as one of the big key questions. It's obviously an oversimplified debate. Nobody believes it's either or anymore. But there are some domains, like language acquisition, seems like there is a bigger scope for nature than maybe social cognition kinds of questions.
You look at these kids as a development psychologist. Does that mean that you can tell, as these things are through nature, or some certain traits are through nature, can you, say, tell which kids are going to be little bastards?
No. No. That's kind
There's no kids in here, it's fine.
No, so the kinds of questions that I'm interested in tend to be basic concepts that are universal things that kids all around the world acquire about the same time, or at least show evidence of having about the same time. I'm less interested in sort of individual differences, predicting those, which kids are going to be geniuses, which kids are going to be psychopaths. There are people out there who do that kind of research, but that's not my area. I'm more sort of interested in basic cognitive abilities that all kids kind of acquire at some point.
how do you do your experiments, I guess? So you get babies into the baby lab, mm-hmm. And I'm assuming there's no treadmills because babies can't do that, but what are the kind of things that you do with the kids?
So one of the questions I'm interested in is object permanence. How do you know that something still exists when you can't see it anymore? This is a major developmental milestone. It's been known for a long time that kids seem to all of a sudden discover this concept around 8 or 10 months. But now that we have newer methods, the original methods of looking at this would just be show a kid a toy and then hide it under a blanket and see whether they reach for it or not. Kids who are younger than 8 months aren't so good at reaching, so they're still kind of developing that. So one of the great things about having new ways of looking at infant development is with new methods, like one that I've used quite a bit is reaching and hiding things by darkness instead of underneath or behind other things. So one of the rooms in my lab is equipped with infrared cameras and sort of light-proofed. So I've done a series of studies looking at, will infants who typically would not search for objects hidden under blankets until 8 or 10 months, if you hide them in the dark, so you just put the object out on the table in front of the infant, prevent them from reaching until it gets hidden, turn the lights off, which hides it, and then look at whether they reach. And we can find that 6- and 7-month-olds actually do quite reliably search for objects in the dark. And I've also done a version that involves hiding objects in milk, which is very messy, very fun. I will never do it again, but it was a really interesting study.
How do you go about designing an experiment? Like all experiments, you have a question that you want to answer, but I imagine actually with kind of the limited developmental skills that these young children have, it must be extra challenging.
It is, yeah. So most of the studies that I do look at infants' looking behavior and their reaching behavior. So we try to design tasks where we can extract information from them with those kinds of measures. So a recent example might be, I've been doing some work on whether infants, if you familiarize them with something in a picture, a 2D image, do they recognize that thing that's in the picture when they come across it in reality? So we've taken a very simple experiment where I have a set of very simple objects, just common infant toys. I've taken life-size color photographs of them. I familiarize the infant with one for a minute, and then I take out the actual toy that was in the picture compared to one that is equally attractive but was not previously depicted, and look at whether they recognize the one from the picture. And the way that I can tell that they do is what they reach for and what they look at. So we can tell that they recognize the object in the picture because they reach more for the novel one, because they're bored with the familiar one that they just spent a minute looking at. So you can kind of look at their eye gaze, what are they looking at preferentially, what do they reach for preferentially.
Oh, wow. That's really cool.
So they're quite simple measures.
Cool. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you.
Patrick Lehman, while not getting whiter than white lab coats or associate dean-sized test tubes, also researches development psychology. However, not with the wee tots, but rather school-age kids and their communication, learning, and social development.
Okay, so I'm a developmental psychologist, and I'm interested principally in how children learn, develop, change, grow, mature psychologically. Slightly different from Jean, who's just been on, I'll focus more on children from school age onwards. And I'm interested also in their social development. So the ways in which they understand the world, the sort of friendships that they form, how they understand gender, but also in terms of school learning and engagement, and particularly things like science learning. So I suppose it's quite apposite in the context of this.
And I asked Jean the same question, but the idea of how much what we know about child psychology and development has changed, what's the differences in kind of learning age and school age? What are the changes in the last 20 years, how we think of how kids learn and socialise?
Well, that's quite a good question. I think in the last 20 years or so, there's certainly been changes that have been inspired by governments and different political ideologies get played out in an educational field. Whether that's changed in many ways how most of us think effective learning happens, I don't know. Perhaps going back a bit further than the last 20 years, though, there is increasingly a shift towards children discovering and learning things for themselves. That's been happening for some time, but increasingly particularly in the context of science learning, there's a greater recognition that, that children learn really well when they get their hands dirty with stuff. Interacting with their peers, generating their own hypotheses, testing them out. Those are really good learning experiences, and children take more and perhaps more conceptually from the more sort of formal frontal lectures that, that you get quite often at universities, actually. So that's perhaps a big change in terms of science teaching. The other big change, which I'm too old to fully appreciate, but I go into schools quite a lot and I see this, is the arrival of information technology, which is assisting learning in a whole variety of different contexts. Even, you know, there's schools now where children have their own iPads, and that's a key learning tool. So I think that's a big change that's just starting and that's coming. But whether it's been fully exploited in terms of children's learning, I don't know.
It is an interesting idea of how you learn all this interesting stuff about child development, but how much does that get reflected back into perhaps the way people train teachers or the way the national curriculum is developed? Does it have any impact?
Well, it does in terms of how teachers are trained. Again, yes, there are other considerations there. So you know, different governments will have different views about the appropriate way to educate, and sometimes even the content of the syllabus and so on. But yes, it does. I think most teacher training courses are informed by theories in psychology, and broadly speaking, they give a very good grounding in terms of how to teach, how to communicate to kids, and how to manage classrooms and all those other things as well. So yes, there's definitely an influence in terms of those things. One of the things that I'm doing at the moment is a big project based in Slough. I think 5 or 6 primary schools in Slough have been involved. We've been looking at how children there learn science with one another. And we're finding out some really interesting things that we definitely hope will feed into the way that those schools go about their science teaching. Hopefully then local and maybe even national government, we might feed in some of the findings from that study too. So.
And you mentioned the project you're working on now. Could you give us a little more details about what's the type of learning and how that goes about in the school?
Okay, so we're looking in these schools in Slough. Children are about 9 years of age. Slough is, it gets a very bad press. I know it does. It's actually a fantastically diverse and vibrant community. It's the most ethnically diverse area in the UK outside of central London. And the rationale for the study was really to look at how children from that diverse ethnic background interact at school, how they go about solving science tasks together, whether that leads to them improving in terms of their science learning, which it does, but also how that impacts their relationships. Because there's a very strong and consistent finding in the developmental and the social psychological literature that children, adults, tend to choose friends from within their own ethnic group. And even at kindergarten, you can see that children, for example, European children will have more European friends, Asian children will have more Asian friends. And that ethnic cleavage actually divides and increases over the course of going to school into adulthood. Obviously, that's not a good thing, because contact means that you get more understanding of different perspectives and better social relationships. So we were looking to see whether that was something involved in these science tasks too.
Cool. So has your study in Slough finished then?
It's coming to finish in the end of May, but we're going to carry on, go back to some of those schools, and we've got lots of plans for other things, looking at how children understand feedback. A lot of my work's been on gender differences in science, and I want to pursue that as well. Science learning, science achievement, and how boys and girls, men and women, choose careers in STEM subjects. So that's one of the things we want to pursue as well.
The whole STEM careers and yes, the gender differences with not enough women in science is one thing that we've covered loads on the podcast, so that's quite fascinating from our perspective.
Get me back and I'll talk about that when I've got some data.
Yes, that would be brilliant. I'm sure you're very busy as an associate dean, so thank you so much.
I'll make time. Thank you. Thanks.
And that's just about it for this week's show. Do check out our website at poddelusion.co.uk, where you can download the show in 3.5 years' worth of podcast archives. Also on our website, you can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, if you're into those sorts of things. And do remember, if you have enjoyed the show this week, please do subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month, or make a one-off donation. We really do appreciate all support, as it helps us pay the server bills and all that sort of things, so please do head over to poddelusion.co.uk and do what you can. The Pod Delusion this week was brought to you by Chris Fitch, Sean Slater, Alex Fitch, Liz Luckendorf, Chris Hofstadter, and me, James O'Malley, with additional editing by Liz. The Sketch of the Moment is by David Lovesey and Brian Too. The Pod Delusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to our annual show, The Cultural Reclassification of Today's Society, or CROFTS as it's better known. This year, the entrants have been placed into one of seven different classes. We join Brian Too at the ringside. Brian.
Thank you, David. Now, in the past, judging has been based on upper, middle, or working, but these new seven classifications really give us something to work with. And first into the ring is the traditional working class. Slightly older than the other breeds represented, they can often be seen being put through their paces, or pacemakers, by making them jump through hoops to get the rewards that they are entitled to.
Excellent, Brian. And have you seen any exciting up-and-comers on display today?
There's a lady just walked past with a lovely schnauzer.
I don't think dogs are allowed in.
No, they're not. I meant she...
But you've been warned about that, Brian. It's just not professional.
Well, why don't we step across and check out the precariat class, previously judged under the obedience category, or to give it its full title, terrified obedience under the heel of the ruling class.
People are asking about the brand new categories though, Brian. Have you seen anything of the new technical middle?
Interestingly, no. Quite a small cross-section of the community, this set, are distinguished by their social isolation and cultural apathy.
You mean they haven't bothered to turn up?
Yes. But now it's time to look at the class that everyone is here to see. The elite group. Were once known as the best in breed, but with a minor and more accurate adjustment, they're now called the best in breed. And the winner is Tarquin St. John Farquharcival! And as his good lady proudly parades him around the ring, we can see him raise his 12-bore and give his victory shout.
Paul! Oh, what's happened there, Brian?
Oh dear, he's so elite. He's accidentally shot himself.
I'd best get the pooper scooper.
No, he's shot himself.
Oh.